Sadly, arrogance and religion seem to go hand in hand far too often. And people are quick to point that out, aren't they? In fact, it's one of the things people seem to dislike most about religion and religious people. They're arrogant, they say. Now, of course, it's a trifle unfair because atheists can be a pretty arrogant bunch too. And so people give up on believing in that stuff too. In fact, give up on believing anything. One writer that I read recently has said that our generation has done something no previous generation has ever done, and that is to commit what he calls credicide, the killing of belief. An old friend of mine, Tim Davis, sums up the reasons rather well when he put it like this. He said, if people believe that ultimate truth exists to be found, well, they're fundamentalists. If they claim to have discovered that truth, well, they're arrogant. If they claim that others haven't understood the truth, well, they're divisive. If they claim that others teach things that are different from the truth, oh, well, they're dogmatic and intolerant. And if they want to live by that truth and call others to live by that truth, well, they're actually harmful. So who on earth wants to be thought of as a divisive, intolerant, harmful, arrogant, and dogmatic fundamentalist? Not me. Do you? A few awkward nods around the room. They're easy insults, aren't they? They're all too common these days. And yet my guess is that if people bothered to study this psalm, they would probably fling the same insults at King David, the writer of this psalm. In fact, some of the things that David says in these verses appear very arrogant indeed. I say appear, because I don't think they are arrogant, but they can seem like it. But all is not what it seems. We need to study it carefully to see why confidence and joy, and this is a song of joy, when confidence and joy, when it comes to the matters of God, are not necessarily arrogant. And here's the irony, here's the paradox. You see, when it comes to the God of the Bible, arrogance and confidence are mutually exclusive. They cancel each other out. And if you can't quite get your head around that, well, listen in, because I think we'll see why that is the case. You're either arrogant or you're confident, if you understand this. You see, the heart of it, the heart of the matter, is that this is a song of joyful praise. And it's joy not because of his own, King David's, achievements, but joy because of God's achievements. And that is what makes all the difference. Well, let's take it in two parts. The first I've called Undivided Hearts for the Promise-Making God. Just have a look at the opening two verses. I will praise you, Lord, with all my heart. Before the gods, I will sing your praise. I will bow down towards your holy temple and will praise your name. Now, I would be very surprised if you disagreed with me about this. But it's a matter of fact that credit should always go where credit is due, don't you think? I'm sure you agree with that, credit where credit's due. And let's imagine that you've been working on a project at work and you've done a really good job. You've put in the hours, you've busted a gut to get the project completed by the deadline. And if you discover afterwards when the whole thing is reviewed and the boss comes and gives his report and so on, it's pretty galling if the newest member of the team, who only joined halfway through the project, gets all the credit, when you're the one who everybody else agrees has worked the hardest. That's not fair. More to the point, that's not right. It's not correct. Credit should go where credit's due. If you've done the work, you should get the credit. Well, how much more the case with God? You see, that's what praise is. Whether in song or in prayer or in the lives we lead, they show where we give credit. It's only giving credit where it's due. Praise to you, O Lord. And when David says you, he's talking about the God of Israel, and he means you only. As he says, you know, there are all kinds of other gods, in quotation marks, gods that people worship. Well, that's true. People worship all kinds of things. But David says, you alone will I praise. You alone are worthy of praise. Because, you see, you alone make promises. Now, that's implicit in his name. I want to be realized. You notice when you see Lord in capital letters in modern translations of the Old Testament, Lord in capital letters, that is basically a sign of Hebrew shorthand. Basically, the name that God revealed of himself, Yahweh, sometimes Jehovah, is the name that God revealed to Moses at the burning bush and to Israel in the book of Exodus. This was God's name, Yahweh. It means I am who I am. I will be who I will be. I am who I am. And it was regarded by ancient believers as so holy that it could not be uttered. And so they would put Adonai, which means Lord, you know, basically just to cover over, just to avoid having to say it as a sort of euphemism. Lord. When you see Lord in capital letters, you're to think Yahweh, the God who speaks, the God who tells you his name, the God who is today, what he will be tomorrow. Do you see that actually his very name tells us something about his very character? If he says he will do something today, tomorrow you can be sure he'll come through. He is faithful to his promises. It speaks of his consistency. He comes through. And this psalm is full of joy in praise for the God who comes through. Now, I've mentioned many people worship different things. They always have, and they no doubt will continue to do so. Many gods, many ideologies. And I'm not actually just talking about religious people. Non-religious people worship as well. I'm talking about the things, actually, when push comes to shove, when you're in a crisis, the things you rely on. The last port of call. The one thing you feel you could not do without. That if you lost that, all really would be lost. I don't know, perhaps it's what you're storing away in your bank. Or the contacts you have in your address book. Contacts in high places. You know, I might get into trouble, but at least I could call X. Or perhaps it's just the innate abilities, the natural gifts you have. You can rely on yourself to get yourself out of a scrape. Or perhaps it's family and friends. Family always stick together, don't they? Or perhaps it's even being religious. Going to church or synagogue or mosque. Perhaps that's what will get you through, see you through. And of course, at the heart of all of this, at the heart of so much religion, at the heart of it all is a contract, a deal. I give the one I worship something, so that this or that God now owes me. I'll scratch his back to make sure he scratches my back. That'll ensure my protection. It's a kind of religious insurance plan. And that's how pagan religion has always worked. It's a deal. It's a contract. But that is not how Yahweh, the God of the Bible, works at all. It's the complete opposite of how he works. He is a God who takes initiatives. You don't have to coax it out of him. In fact, he takes initiatives before we even gave him a moment's thought. So I think we can see two reasons why David is wholehearted, undivided for this God. First of all, he's wholehearted because of God's heart. He knows something of his character. Look how verse 2 carries on. I will praise your name for your unfailing love and your faithfulness. You so exalted your solemn decree that it surpasses your fame. When I called you, you answered me. You greatly emboldened me. You made me bold, not arrogant, bold. Now, what is the foundation for this praise? Well, there are two characteristics of God that he's particularly praising God for, his unfailing love and his faithfulness. They come first. God takes the initiative. There's no contract. There's no deal here. He does it. This is what he's like. He takes the initiative even before we have even imagined what our crisis might be. He's already proved himself. But it's even better than you think. Faithfulness, well, that's obvious. We've already hinted at it. His name tells us about that. He's faithful to promises he's made. He is consistent. What he is today, he will be tomorrow. I am who I am. I will be who I will be. You can count on me. That's what I'm like, he says. He's faithful. But then there's this concept of unfailing love. It's a very difficult word in Hebrew to translate. It's one of those impossible but beautiful words, chesed. It's one of the most beautiful words of any language. It means, well, so much, but at the very least, it means compassionate love, faithful, kind love, gracious and undeserved love. It is the kind of love that is willing to love the unlovely. We can all love the lovely, but to love the unlovely, the broken, the failed, the flawed, and the fallen, that is some love. That is chesed. It's a love that defies expectations and goes beyond just desert. It is a pure gift. We've rather lost that in our society. So little that we experience in life is a pure gift. You know, we say there's no such thing as a free lunch. Gary Chapman is an American Christian counselor. I think he puts it rather well, so I'm going to quote from him. He said, "A true gift is not payment for services rendered. Rather, it's an expression of love for the individual and is freely given by the donor. In our society, not all giving is so sincere, especially in the business world. Much of it is payback for doing business or a bribe in the hope of future business. The item is not given simply for the benefit of the recipient, but is more a way of saying thank you for a financial contribution or a request for a future contribution. The gift benefits the donor, not the recipient." But that's not how God works. He is full of unfailing love. A God who promises gifts and gives gifts because he's consistent and faithful. And that is why uniquely he is worthy of praise. There is no other God like this. And David sees God's answers in verse 3 to his cries for help as part of this. It is part of God's ongoing gracious giving. It's not God in a contract. It's God being true to himself. It's what he's like. There's no one like him. Credit where credit is due. But this is where it gets a bit more tricky. Because it's one thing to talk about this from personal experience, but to go on to the next bit, to say that this has global implications because of God's glory. Look at verses 5 and 6. "May all the kings of the earth praise you, Lord, when they hear what you have decreed. May they sing of the ways of the Lord, for the glory of the Lord, of Yahweh, is great." All the kings of the earth? I mean, some might say, well, it's all right for you, King David. Yeah, okay, you, one king, but all the kings? I don't know whether you've thought about this before, but this is one of the most surprising aspects of ancient Judaism. The Jewish people, they were tiny, minute in number compared to the nations around them. Their territory was constantly vulnerable to attack. They were surrounded. And if you know anything of Old Testament history, you'll see that pattern being repeated again and again. And yet, they stuck to their convictions. They believed in only one God and believed that he was the only one worthy of their praise. Now, you might not think that's particularly unusual. Well, I can tell you, it really is. And they believed that he was the one God that the whole world should praise. Even though, compared to everybody else, they were puny and vulnerable and weak. You see, to understand why that's amazing, we've got to understand how pagan religion always works and always has. You see, the logic is simple. If your gods do not deliver in a crisis, then you ditch them and move on to better gods, stronger gods. And that's only reasonable. You know, if this doesn't work, you try something that does. And, you know, if there's war coming in, conflict, then it makes perfect sense. If the other guys beat you in a conflict, in a war, well, it must mean the other guy's gods are better than yours, are stronger. So ditch your own, move to theirs. They're obviously better. Makes perfect sense to shift. But the Jewish people refused. They refused to do it. Even, and this is the most extraordinary thing, even after defeat in battle and exile to Babylon. In fact, even in Babylon, there were people who clung on almost for dear life. People like Daniel, to the belief that their God was the God who comes through, and more to the point, that their God was the God that the whole world should know. Even people like Jeremiah and Ezekiel, who suffered greatly at that time, believed that this was the God for the world. I mean, that's pretty arrogant, isn't it? As well as pretty illogical. Not only arrogant, but intolerant and divisive. But stop for a moment. Think about it like this. Imagine that you're in a situation and you need a really, well, a very dangerous heart operation. Imagine that it is so complex that most cardiologists think it's not even worth attempting to operate. It's just too difficult. And so one after the other, they say to you, I'm sorry, but there's really nothing that we can do. Emails shoot off to all the world's leading hospitals just to see in case there's one, but the replies are all the same. I'm sorry. It's just too dangerous. And then suddenly one cardiologist replies, look, I know what everybody's saying, but I think I can do this. I can save your life. Trust me. Now, do you dismiss that as just arrogant? How dare you say that? I mean, it's saying that the only person in the world who can do this operation, how arrogant is that? No, that's not the question. The issue is not whether or not they're arrogant, but the issue is she able to do the operation? Is she correct to make the claim? In fact, arrogance is irrelevant. What matters is, can she do it? That's what matters. Your life depends on it. So it is with believing God to be worthy of praise, uniquely. Arrogance is not anything to do with it. The issue is he worthy? Can he be trusted? Does he come through? Now, of course, some people who believe that are arrogant. There are plenty of religious people. There are plenty of Christians who come across as very arrogant and who perhaps are arrogant. And that's something that needs to be challenged and dealt with. But believing this by itself is not arrogant. The issue is whether or not it's true. And the psalmist believed that credit was due to God alone. You alone, above all gods, are worthy to be praised. Because God alone is a God of grace, undeserved mercy, a God of chesed. No one else is. You will not find the concept of chesed anywhere else. Let's see how this gets worked out in the last bit of the psalm from verses 6 to 8. What we see is unexpected blessings from the promise-making and promise-keeping God. And the first surprise is that arrogance has no place at all. Humility is required. Have a look at verse 6. Though Yahweh, the Lord, is exalted, he looks kindly on the lowly. Though lofty, he sees them from afar. You see, Yahweh is a God with an eye for the little guy. He notices the people that the world fails to notice. For with him, humility is crucial. It's fundamental. Because without humility, we'll never accept the need for grace. We'll never accept that we need undeserved mercy, because we'll always assume we deserve it. We'll assume that we deserve God's gifts and blessings. Well, of course I should get his gifts. We'll assume that we have some sort of right to the things that God is and offers. we'll assume it's part of the deal. Well, you know, I've scratched his back, he just scratched mine. It's my right. That's how it works, isn't it? Well, not with Yahweh. The Bible consistently says we do not deserve God's good things because we've rejected God. Oh, come off it. I mean, now you're not just being arrogant, you're being offensively intolerant. It's quite a morning now, isn't it? It's all stacking up. But can we honestly say that we have lived in God's world as we should? Daily? 24/7? Can we honestly say that we have always given him credit where it's due for everything? Have we depended upon him in everything? Have we praised him, worshipped him, loved him for his creation of us? His provision for us. His love for us. You see, we all live in God's world as if it was our world, which is not giving credit where it's due. That's what the Bible calls sin. But this is where it gets amazing. Do you see that in verse 6? Though Yahweh is exalted, he looks kindly on the lowly. Those who recognize this. Those who confess and seek him. He is, you see, the God of the second chance. In fact, his loving kindness means he's the God of the 2,002nd chance. But it takes humility to accept that. It takes humility to say, I need help. Isn't that why so many men don't ask for directions in the car? It's not just men, actually, is it? Let's face it. Don't have the humility to ask for help. It's not the dumb thing to ask for help at work, is it? You've got to be self-sufficient. You've got to be reliable. You mustn't ask for help. You mustn't say there's something you can't do. You'll lose your job. When it comes to God, there's something fundamental that we can't do. And that is to live for him. Do you have the humility to ask for his help? It's not easy. But don't worry. According to verse 6, God, though he's high up, he can see it a mile off. Even if you're only just beginning to come to terms with it in the secrecy of your heart, nobody else knows. But God does. He can see it a mile off. The American preacher D.L. Moody was absolutely spot on when he said this. God sends no one away empty, except those who are full of themselves. He sends no one away empty except those who are full of themselves. He looks kindly on the lowly. Because that's what he's like. Secondly, we see a life preserved. Verse 7, though I walk in the midst of trouble, you preserve my life. You stretch out your hand against the anger of my foes with your right hand. With your right hand, you save me. Okay, well, here's the floor. This is where it all falls apart. The house of cards just collapses. You know, the psalmist speaks of his experience of God's provision and preservation in the midst of real distress. There's hostility, there's danger. But God saves me, he says. And you think, did he? Really? What about those times in Israel's history when, frankly, that didn't happen? What about when Israel was defeated by the Babylonians and the temple was destroyed and the people went into exile? Did God save them then? Well, here's the interesting thing. You see, even in the face of these terrible events, even in exile, they continued to believe that Yahweh was in control and that he was keeping his promises. And they continued to believe that the promise-making, promise-keeping God was the Lord of all the earth, even when they were slaves imprisoned as exiles. You see, they believed he has a purpose, a plan, and promises to keep. So finally, we see promises kept, or do we? Verse 8, The Lord will vindicate me. Your love, Lord, endures forever. Do not abandon the works of your hands. Now, hang on. Do you notice just a very subtle change of tone in that last line? After all this confidence from verses 1 to the beginning of 8, the joy and praise of the psalm so far for all God's goodness and love, there's now a closing appeal. Lord, please do this again. Do what you've done in the past. Do it again. In other words, the psalmist is in trouble again. No idea what it is now, but he appeals to God's loving kindness, his faithfulness, which he says endures forever. Don't abandon me. Not now. Question is, will God come through? Will he deliver? Will he keep those promises? Well, to answer that, we need to track forward a few centuries to the darkest moment in Israel's history. In fact, the darkest moment in world history. It was a moment when God really did look as though he'd left. He'd abandoned his world. A day of deepest darkness. It was the moment when his son was slowly and agonizingly asphyxiating on a cross. Did God come through for Jesus? On Good Friday, it really didn't look it. Why have you forsaken me? He cried out. Did God come through for Jesus? Well, the answer is a resounding yes. Because, you see, we're still in the season of Easter. Easter hasn't stopped. It's not just one day. And it reminds us of this extraordinary, revolutionary, overwhelming moment when death was defeated. When God's king was vindicated. Just as his great predecessor David cried for God to vindicate him in our psalm. That moment when divine love and faithfulness were seen to defeat and endure over sin and darkness. You see, Jesus died to take on himself what I deserve for my sin, what you deserve for your sin. To take our just deserts, to give us what we never deserved. His eternal love. His chesed. This victory is what brings God's saving work. He's saving us from sin. And from the consequences of that. So verse 7, God stretches out his hand to save. Verse 8, his love does indeed endure forever. Christ died and rose again and sits on the throne in heaven forever. This is the victory of the cross and resurrection of Jesus Christ in time and space, in human history, and for eternity. But is it arrogant to believe that? Is it arrogant to say that's true? Well, for starters, it actually takes humility to believe it. To accept that I can't save myself is humiliating. God puts us in our place, doesn't he? The only reason you need rescue is if you can't save yourself. You see, humility, though, does not prevent confidence. How can I know that I'm saved? Well, because Christ has done for me on the cross what I could never have done for myself. He has vindicated me. He has stretched out his hand to save me. He's pulled me out of the pit. Did I deserve that? No. Can I be sure of that? Yes. Can I contribute to it? Well, you see, even if I could contribute even the minutest amount, then suddenly it would knock out all confidence I could possibly have, because there would always be that sliver of doubt that I might not actually pull through, that I might not actually come up trumps when in a crisis, that actually some part of it, depending on me, removes all confidence whatsoever and actually makes me proud. Because I start beginning to think, hey, see what I've done? To think you can save yourself, that is arrogance. Which is a very different thing from confidence. You see, being saved does not mean I'm better than those who aren't. It doesn't make me a more righteous or holy person necessarily. It just means I've been forgiven by Him. And that's why I want you to be forgiven too. Not because I think you're worse than me, but because I think you're the same as me. It's not divisive. But is it arrogant of Jesus to say He can do this? And is it arrogant to say that the whole world should know about this? Well, let's come back finally to the cardiologist. Like the cardiologist, Jesus is not arrogant if He can pull it off. If He can pull through and come and do what He says He's going to do. You see, arrogance is irrelevant. The issue is, can He save me from my sins? And not just can, has He saved me from my sins? Now, we know for a fact that when you look at His life, He wasn't arrogant at all. He was confident, but He wasn't arrogant. And even though He's lofty, He sees and looks out for and loves the lowly. And because He's telling the truth, He is worthy of praise and love, worthy of devotion and dependence, credit where credit is due. That is enough to make the heart sing, isn't it? So as I close, let me ask, do you have anything better than this? Who or what else has claimed as much as Jesus has claimed and delivered what He has delivered? Does anybody else get close? Who else can prove eternal love? And here's the big one. Who else has died for you that you might live for Him? Who else? There are lots of gods. There are lots of things people worship. Which of them has died for you? I would suggest that there is no other in all the world. Before all gods, I worship you, Yahweh, in Jesus. And that is why Christians, in all humility, because we know our sin, and yet in all confidence, because we know God's gift, can echo the psalmist's song, I will praise you, Yahweh, with all my heart. Before the gods, I will sing your praise. So the only question as I finish is, do you have the humility to join in the song? Or are you relying on something else? Let's pray. May all the kings of the earth praise you, Yahweh. Heavenly Father, we praise and thank you that you've revealed yourself. You've revealed your name. You've revealed your character. You've revealed your purposes. And you have kept your promises because of your unfailing love. We long that we might live in confidence of that love and draw all others, whether the kings of the earth or the lowly, the neighbors or the colleagues, the friends, the strangers, to know your love as well. In Jesus' name, amen.